You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Cheryl Ramstad. She's got an amazing story to share. And this introduction is a little bit long, but there are two things that relate to this interview that I think you guys might want to know. These are things that come up. This is the 148th interview. That's a lot. And for people who have been listening to me from the beginning, you probably feel like you have an idea of who I am as a person, or you may have questions. And so let's talk about it. Cheryl's got an amazing story. In fact, her story is so impressive that what brings her to the show is that she's published a memoir. So one thing you may or may not know is that podcasts, audio podcasts, and books, those are pretty related audiences. And so it's pretty frequent that book publishers and book marketers want to reach out to podcasts as part of the promotional circuit. Now, from my perspective, I find that sometimes talking to authors about their books when they're in the middle of their release push can be tricky to produce an interesting conversation. And this is because of two things, I think. One is that authors who are promoting their books can sometimes do a lot of interviews. And this has two impacts of things that can happen. They can get very, very good at telling the story of their book. And that sounds like it's a great thing for an interview. But in my experience, sometimes the impact is that the conversation is stiff and not great. And so when I'm putting together my ideas for what I want to talk to an author about when they're promoting a book, I do my best to find conversation topics that have my own special sauce, if you will. Cheryl's story is that when she was 29, she was in a plane crash. That's a pivotal moment of anybody's life, and it happens. And that is, for her, not surprisingly, the moment her life changed. And I for sure was curious to talk to somebody who had that experience in their life. I talked to Cheryl about what her life was like before, what she was like before. We talk about her healing journey and we talk about pushing limits because she went on to do some amazing things. We talk about working through hard times and how her experience with the plane crash and the healing continued to be a through line in her life. You guys, have never been in a plane crash. And as I wrote that out when I was writing this introduction, I realized how much I hope that tidbit stays true for me and my whole life, to be honest. As I was figuring out the questions I wanted to ask Cheryl, my goal was to find things that brought her experience as close to what I think you and I will have in common with her experience. And you'll have to let me know if you think I did a good job with that. One of the things that it turns out is a big part of Cheryl's book and her journey is her personal religious faith. And as I was putting together things I wanted to ask Cheryl about, I decided that I wanted to talk to Cheryl about making the decision of including that in her book. And I want to take a minute and explain to you why that felt important to me. And I don't know if anybody is going to care, but here we go. The Art of Imperfect Adulting is not a faith-based platform. In fact, if you were to get into my head and ask me what was my purpose with the show, my hope is to share stories that include a wide variety of experiences and perspective, specifically things that are different than mine, and to bring them all together in a place that is entertaining and helpful. That's my goal as the host, right? I do sometimes in this little podcasting streaming content bubble where I live, have a gut check moment when I am interviewing somebody, I'm sharing somebody's story that I am aware that it might feel like me having a person on as a guest is related to the fact that I must share their views or ideology or thoughts on a certain topic. To be perfectly honest, sometimes that's going to be true and sometimes it's not. Almost always the first time I have a conversation with somebody is when I record the interview. So I don't even know who they are other than what they've pitched. In this situation, I had the chance to read the book before I talked to Cheryl. And so I knew that this was a big part of her book. I do feel like right now in 2025, the most common strategy that I'm seeing when people are dealing with polarizing topics like religion and politics is to either avoid the topic altogether or to group it together in silos of similarity, right? So this would be where you've got like a politically aligned channel. Like this is a conservative channel. This is a Christian radio station. Those are silos of similarity. There is a potentially problematic scenario that I see sometimes where, which I call the wolf in sheep's clothing situation, which is where the content has a theme or an agenda or a similar ideology or a message, but it's not overt, it's semi-obscured. Right now in August in 2025, I'm seeing many people that I followed online as personal brands, small businesses who have been solely rooted in business content or hobby content or, you know, sales, whatever it is, but no ideology at all, are suddenly all of a sudden bringing up their personal religion in a very public way. And I think that's why I might feel compelled to be very clear and be like, hey, this The Art of Imperfect Adulting is not a faith-based channel. But at the same time, when somebody's personal faith journey is a part of their story, I have decided that I'm not going to step away from it, that instead I'm going to try my best to bring it into the open and make it a part of the conversation in a helpful way, in an entertaining way. Let's figure out where that's going to go. So I decided to go ahead and bring it up in this conversation and ask things like, hey, was this a part of your planning process in creating this book? Did you think about whether to include it or not? Is it a faith-based or a religious book? Is this a book that actually is only for people who share the faith that you do? I ask all of those questions and you get to listen and see how Cheryl responds. All right, enough of me rambling on with my challenge about trying to be a host who shares a wide variety of stories in a fair and entertaining way. Let's get to it, shall we? Cheryl Ramstad, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm so happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I sure am, and I'm so excited to be here and to be visiting with you, Amy. It's a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. I start all of my conversations with my guests the very same way. I ask people what part of the world they call home. So tell us where you are.
I am in the Bold North, also known as the Land of 10,000 Lakes, which is Minnesota.
Ah, very nice. Very, very nice. I have one more warm-up question, which is, what is the most a recent compliment you gave someone, a word of kindness or something nice you said, even if it was just something small from earlier today?
Well, as a matter of fact, it was earlier today. My husband's been hospitalized, and I had a wonderful respiratory therapist who literally saved his life. So I came home after sleeping in the hospital all night. I came home, baked some chocolate chip cookies, and took them to her and said, "Thank you so much. You saved my husband's life."
Holy moly. I've been asking this question for a couple of weeks now, but that is an intense story. You've had quite a 24-hour period. Wow. I thanked you when we started for taking time out of your day, but you've got a lot going on. I'm very thankful that you would make a break in your day to do an interview.
I'm very thankful that he's doing okay, thanks to that therapist.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. All right. Topic of the day is that, let's back up. All right. So on the show, I share stories of choices and changes, which is a really, really broad description. I can break it down in a bunch of different ways. And one of the ways that I can classify these discussions is if we split the choices into things people do electively. They make up their mind and they're making a choice and a change on their own because they want something to change in their life. The other group can be classified as changes we make because things happen to us, things that are out of control. And that's where yours falls in. When you were 29, you were in a plane crash. And we're going to talk about some of the ways that that changed your life. Does that sound good?
It does. And actually, there were some elective changes that transpired after that as a result of the plane crash. So I have a bit of both in my life.
I think everyone has both. And it's, it's an arbitrary designation. Because you have the choices and there is that, but you clearly did not wake up and say, you know what I'm going to do today is be in a plane crash. And so that is where I sort of generally break it down versus a change that's like, hey, I'm going to change my relationship. I'm going to go back to school. Those sort of really self-directed decisions. But let's go back to the beginning. I would like to know about you when you were in your 20s, before all this happened. I think when this happened, you were finished with school, but tell us about what you were studying, what your dreams were, what was going on in your relationships, marriage, what were your dreams for yourself professionally and personally? Who were you like when you were in your 20s?
Well, I, at the age of 12, decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And so I followed that path to law school after graduating from the University of Minnesota and started out in the criminal law field as a public defender for Hennepin County, which is the Minneapolis area. I then became a federal prosecutor, which is the position that I was in when I was in the airplane crash. My dreams were to be in the trial courtroom as much as I could. I loved it. I thrived on it. It was exciting, exhilarating. It was living out Nancy Drew and Perry Mason from my 12-year-old history. And there I was, and I was doing well, and I was getting victories in the courtroom and seeing that justice was done. And so it was an exciting time for me, really the highlight. 3 years before my crash, I was married to a man who I had met in the Twin Cities, and I was new to the Twin Cities, originally from North Dakota. And so I got to know him, and we had planned. He was a pilot already. His dad was an aviation expert in the area. And we had planned our lifestyle would be to own a private plane, to be able to take it on vacations and to various places, business and otherwise, we were going, and that I would be able to be stand in if something should happen to him. So that was my reason for taking flying lessons, was to be abundantly careful that if anything ever happened and the two of us were in a plane and something went wrong, I could take over.
That's a big part of the story because I shared that you were in a plane crash and this but you one of the things that makes this unique is that you were not a passenger in a plane that somebody else was flying. You were piloting. This happened in 1979, me demonstrating that I did my homework and read chunks of the book. I am curious if there were a lot of women going through flight training in 1979.
It's interesting, Amy. The only way I would know that is from my ground school, and I would say maybe 25% of the ground school class that I took at the University of Minnesota were women.
Oh,
But
that's good.
when you're taking lessons, it's you and the instructor, and you're really not cognizant of who else is out there learning. So I would say a handful, but it wasn't a common thing.
I mean, and when I was putting this together, I was thinking about it because the commercial pilot split is very much, it's pretty public, the majority men, and it's a big deal when there is like an all-female crew in these days, even so many years forward. But then when I thought about it, I was like, yeah, but there could have been, this is small planes and in rural places, there's no reason that there wouldn't have been maybe a lot of women flying. So I really just didn't know. And that's why I was like, let me ask whether or not this was something that was pretty common because no, absolutely. So the idea was you were married, you guys were putting together this dream life, you were gonna fly, get a private plane to use for your vacations and your passions and do these things. That was the driver of this flight. You're in flight school, is how this happens. And this is your first solo flight. And so you mentioned on the first page of your book that your mom had concerns about your safety flying at the time. Do you remember getting any other pushback from anybody else in your community, social, family about you taking flying lessons?
Well, I did it kind of under the radar. I wasn't broadcasting it. I didn't have a network of other women who were flying. And so I really wasn't making others aware of it. But my mother and I were very close, and she was a worrier and was worried about my flying. And so that's why she brought up the topic the day before we went out. I went out for my first solo, and I tried to reassure her that it's safer than driving a car or walking across the street. Although I'm not sure I convinced her.
Yeah. Well, and did you have, I mean, you were in the throes of doing it, and you, it sounds to me that you were a very, very confident person with an independent mind pursuing a career in law, things like that. But did you have concerns, or did you feel like it was just a very, very safe thing that you were doing?
I had confidence in my skills. I'm a careful person. I'm a precise person. I listened attentively. I'm a good student. My instructor had assured me that I was ready.
Yeah.
And I did. When you do a solo flight, you go up with your instructor initially and fly around the field. And then he got out, and that was my turn to take control of the plane. The solo consists of doing three touch and goes, which means that you fly in a flight pattern, rectangular around the airfield. You go out a ways and then you come back 90 degrees and then you come back and then you're cleared for final. And you touch down briefly and then you take off again. So you do that two times. Well, the first two touch and goes that I did were flawless. They were perfect. And on my third touch and go, I was had taken off, gone downwind, and was cleared for final when all of a sudden, silence, the engine quit. First it sputtered and then it quit. And I had time for three communications with the tower. I said, the engine's sputtering, the engine's quit, help, I can't stop it. And there was about a 20-second lag between the time I said that and the time that the crash occurred. So during that time, the air traffic controller was trying to clear the airspace so that other planes would get out of my way because they knew I was in trouble. And during that time, I did something that really saved my life, which is I didn't pull back on the throttle like a lot of new pilots would do, because you'd think that that would bring the nose of the plane up. Well, that would have cost me my life, because if you bring the nose of the plane up, it spirals down, you nosedive into the ground, and you're gone. But when it happened, when this engine quit, I was over the Interstate 94, the 30, the Mississippi River, our state capitol building, and there was no place to put it down. There was really no place that looked like it would be safe. I didn't think I'd survive at that point, but I didn't want to take others with me in the river. It was the 4th of July weekend, Saturday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 4th of July weekend. And the river was full of boats with people in them. The freeway was full of cars. And obviously, the state capitol is an immovable building. And then there was this residential area close by. So I just set the plane at landing speed and in 20 seconds was on my way down. And on the way down, a power line took off the wing, and that sprayed the fuel all over the cockpit in which I was sitting. The tank exploded, and I was in an inferno, and I
Wow.
just had no place to go. But the plane fortunately hit a tree because it brought me to a stop. And again, I realized that I was going to burn up alive. That's what I thought. And so I reacted very immediately to unlatch the door. The doors had jammed during the impact. And so I, again, instinctively took all my body weight, threw it against the door that was on fire, and climbed. And fortunately, miraculously, it popped open. And I was able to climb out through the fire, my hair on fire, my face, my whole body on fire, and get out safely. And that's when people from the neighborhood started gathering because they had felt their houses shake when this plane was going down. It was a densely populated residential area. And just to give you an idea of how fortunate it was that I didn't kill myself or others, the plane crashed 10 feet from a woman sunbathing in her backyard on that beautiful
Oh, goodness.
afternoon. So people knew and they started rushing out to see what had happened.
That is one of the things that I find really interesting about this is that you have such a very clear memory of the moments. There were two things that came to mind actually when I was reading it. One was, I've never experienced anything like this at all, and so I have no concept of it, but you knew you were crashing, and so you had the pressure and the stress and you were in it. Like it's like the impending. It wasn't like there's like a hang time. Like a hang time. It wasn't like, oh gosh, something's wrong and then it's over. You had some stuff you had to deal with, and I thought that must have been incredibly stressful. But the other thing that came to mind for me is that often when people go through really, really stressful acute things where they are hurt, they don't have a clear memory of what happened right before. And so when I was reading this and looking at the detail of everything that happened, I was like, I don't know if that's good or bad that you have a clear memory of it. Was it always like that, or was some of it reconstructed from what people told you after?
It was always indelibly in my mind. And if I could describe it today, I could reenact it today. It's so vivid in my mind. Every second of that 20 seconds was just imprinted on my mind, in my mind. So and even after I got out and was on fire, and this man helped me across the street because he was a commercial pilot, and he came over and wanted to make sure nobody else was on board the plane. And I said, "No, it was my first solo. Why did the engine quit?" And his comment to me was, "I don't know, but I'm a commercial pilot. I just want you to know you did a damn good job of flying because you could have killed yourself and others in the neighborhood." Well, he walked me across the street where there was a Catholic church, and the priest came out and gave me last rites as I collapsed on the sidewalk.
Good.
I remember that very vividly. I remember the people backing away as if I had a contagious disease as I was walking across the street because, they didn't know what to do. But this man was kind enough to come forward, and it was very comforting to me. Then I remember the fire chief coming, and he asked me specifically, who should I notify? And I told him, because I remembered my mother's conversation with me the day before, "Please do not contact my parents. Have my brother do that. Please contact my brother to have him talk to my parents." So it was very clear in my mind. When I started to fade was when I got to the hospital. The ambulance came and took me to the hospital, to the burn unit, about a mile from the crash site. And when I was in there, I remember that they were cutting off my clothing, which should, what was left of it, so that they could get at the burns. And a nurse came in and said, "There's a reporter from the local newspaper who wants to come in and take pictures and interview you." And I just remember the vivid thought of, "Oh, please don't, please don't." And somebody in the room said, "No, she's in no condition for that." And that's when I started fading. I think they gave me pain medication and they started working on cleaning up my burns. So at that point, until I woke up in my room the middle of the night and I was up in the burn center, saw my mom sitting there with the Bible in her lap. She and my dad had chartered a private plane to get down from their lake cabin. And that's the next memory I have of what happened. And then there were gaps thereafter. There was a period of about 2 weeks when they said my life was in the balance. I had a terrible infection, peritonitis, and they said the doctors gave me a 1% chance of surviving. And that is a gap in my mind memory too. But otherwise, I remember so much about that experience. It's never going to leave me.
It's an incredible experience and one that most people will never go through, which is a thing to be thankful for, those of us who have not experienced it. And I say that mostly because I don't think there's any way for me to even imagine what any part of this was or what something like this, the impact that it would have on the decisions that, you make moving forward. Because it's like a stack of decisions and a stack of situations that are out of your control. Before the crash, it sounds like you were a very driven person. I'm going to put you in the category of type A. Is that accurate?
Very accurate. I live
Okay.
by lists. In fact,
Okay.
I had a list of what I was going to do after my first solo, and it was down to the minute of how many minutes it would take to go to the gym, how many minutes to get groceries, how many minutes to prepare for a meeting the following Monday. And I was determined, didn't think that anything could be done by anyone else. Little did I know it would wait months before I'd be able to ever do anything on that list again.
Oh my goodness. Well, one of the stereotypes of modern people in medicine is that driven type A people struggle to be sick and receive care, especially in hospitals. And so while it's one thing to say, of course, you were very lucky and fortunate to make it out of this catastrophic event, but share a little bit about how long you were in the hospital and some of that struggle, which you do bring up, which is to that you were not in control of driving this medical process in the hospital. People were coming in and talking over you and around you and not asking you for your opinions. How did that go?
It was very frustrating, very confusing. I remember getting out of this. I had seven major surgeries, and I remember getting out of the operating room and not knowing what the outcome was, and nobody really talking to me. They were kind of talking over me and wondering what had happened in the operating room. I remember some of the people who were very there were a few people who were very kind, but I remember people who, my hand was bandaged because they were going to amputate this hand. It was burned right down to the bone, and the doctor threw some skin on, thinking that as a trial lawyer, I used my hands, and so he was hoping that he could save it. Fortunately for me, it did. He did. But I remember the person who, the nurse's aide, who came in and yelled at me because I was trying to pick up something with this bandaged hand, and dropped it. And so I remember insensitive things like that. I remember feeling like I wasn't part of the treatment team, that it was something being done to me rather than with me. And truthfully, that's what caused me years later. I donated or volunteered time to go up to the burn unit for many years while I pursued my career. We adopted three children. And eventually, when I was sitting as a judge full time, I decided, if not now, when I need to go up to that burn unit where I was a patient and I need to give back because I understand what those people are going
Yeah.
through and most people don't. And that's my responsibility. And so I started taking prerequisites for nursing as a second career, which, to go from being a judge to a nurse, nobody does that. Nobody in the School of Nursing at the University of Minnesota had ever done that. Took me 4 years of taking one prerequisite each semester for that entire period I was on the bench working full time. And when I applied, I thought, why would they accept me? I'm 62 years old. I don't, think that they'd want to spend the resources training me at this point, but I was very motivated. I felt very led to do that. And, lo and behold, when I got my acceptance letter, again, I hadn't told anybody I was doing this. For 4 years, I hadn't said what my aspiration was. And so I resigned my judgeship and
Oh.
went back to school full time. And there were rumors running rampant that I was dying of cancer. People couldn't figure it out because even my brother said, Cheryl, people live their lifetime and do their whole career to become a judge. And why are you giving that up? But I really felt in my heart that I needed to do that. And there were ways in which it was really affirmed. Amy, I did a one of the responsibilities I had. I went on and got my nursing degree, and then I went on and got my doctorate. So I was in school for 5 years at the University of Minnesota, and we had certain choices along the way, and one choice was where I wanted to do my practicum, and I wanted to go back to the burn unit where I'd been a patient. And then they offered me a job there part-time while I was going to finish my master or my doctorate. And one of the things they asked me to do was conduct a support group for burn survivors and their spouses and family. And one man who I'd been helping, his gas can blew up in his face, badly burned, was in that support group meeting one night with his wife, and she came over and she said, I've heard so much about you from Jeff. She said, I'm so glad to meet you. She said, we lived in that neighborhood where your plane crashed, and I was scheduled to go to a church in that very Catholic church where the priest came out and gave you last rites. And in fact, we were standing there praying right with him when you were lying there on the sidewalk. So, there were ways in which I felt like it was full circle, and I was able to help others who were going through similar things. Similarly, the doctor called me back on a number of occasions when there were people who wanted to know if they'd ever run again. And one of the things I did as part of my recovery, a nurse had seen a picture of me on my bedstand of me running Bonnie Bell race a week before the crash. And literally, I had been training for a marathon the morning of my crash and fighting for my survival by that night. So she said to me, she said, wanting to give me hope, Cheryl, in 2 years, you'll be running that marathon and I'll be at the finish line to cheer you on. Well, that became my goal. And so when others wanted to know if they'd ever be able to exercise, run, ride a bike, whatever, play basketball, the doctor would call me and say, could you go in and see this patient, please? And just share with the patient your experience and how you did it. So I felt like it was a doorway to being able to help others through things that I had learned the hard way. It also gave me a different perspective when I got my doctorate in nursing. I went into teaching nursing at three colleges, and I shared with those nursing students the importance of including patients as part of the team and for them to know what was going on and the communication that has to take place between the patient and the care provider in order to really do your job in an appropriate way.
Absolutely. Which, as an outsider, someone who's not in the medical system at all and have had a generally very healthy life, so my exposure to this is, very, very minimal. But it just seems like such a very, first of all, it's in many, many movies, folks. But also, it seems like it makes a lot of sense. And it's one of the things that is a through line for this show in my own little way, which is to elevate the voice of people with experience alongside the voices of professionals and experts. So it's not really an or, but and. People can have very professional experiences, but those who have walked the walk, they have a lot to add. They have a lot to add. And so I think that's good. I'm going to take a second and invite the audience to join us on social media. So for every episode, I post a discussion question. This is an amazing story of Cheryl's, of an event in her life and a beautiful life she led. So come join us on social media, join the conversation. I'll be there. I'll invite Cheryl there. There'll be other people from the community in there. It's super fun. If you don't have the social accounts, if you're not already connected, they're in the show notes. So, coming back to the story, I don't have any experience in being in the burn unit or being or recovering from a plane crash, but not even a little bit. Clearly, because you're talking to me today and you've built this amazing life that we've talked a little bit about, you do recover. You go on to run marathons, you climb mountains, you build an amazing family, you adopt three kids, you mentioned that, build a career in law, you're a judge, you go back to school, you become a nurse, and you get a doctorate in nursing. Amazing. I love it. It's amazing. Would you say that your drive increased after the accident and the recovery, or were you did was that not the thing that changed? Were you just as driven before and you just continued to be driven after the recovery?
I would say that the prevalent thought I kept having was to not ask why me, but what next? And that's what guided me throughout the rest of my decisions was what next? Not to look
Okay.
back and regret anything, but to try to learn from it and use it in a positive way to say what next? What can I do next?
That's a really interesting way to say that. That's one of the techniques that people use to teach how to move through really stressful situations, right? So, the only way out is through. So it doesn't matter kind of how you got there. It's like, what do what is the goal and how are you going to get there? So I mentioned this before. There's like a stack of choices, and this is like a really, really complex, vibrant story of the things that you have done in your life. And many of the things that we're talking about are places where you chose to push the limits or push beyond a boundary. Like, I'm going to learn how to fly. I'm going to run a marathon. I'm going to be a judge. I'm going to climb a mountain. But I actually want to talk a little bit about the time when you were in the hospital healing, because I'm not the end all be all expert on human experience, but I do think that most people have seasons of hardship in their life, times in their life where the awareness that there's even a choice at all in front of them is kind of hard to see. And so I just think that sometimes it doesn't feel like there's a choice. And I wondered if when you were in the hospital and you were recovering, you were surrounded by people, but still the job of healing was yours and something only you could do for yourself. There was a point where, it was your body and your experience. So I had a question, which is whether or not you had any guidance, or thoughts that would be helpful or uplifting for people who might feel like they're in a season where there are no choices in front of them, for what it felt like to you to be living in that moment and making that repetitive choice to keep persevering moment after moment.
That's an excellent question, and I'd say that three things got me through it: my faith, my family, and my friends. I was very blessed that those people in my life really encouraged me. They were at my bedside. They brought me pizzas in the burn unit when I was capable of eating. They kept vigil when I was totally out of it during that 2 week time when they didn't know if I'd survive. And Amy, it's really interesting because to this day, when I read about or hear about or see on the television about a plane crash, I want to reach out to those family members. I want to reach out to those people because people reached out to me in the burn center. There was a Republic Airlines pilot, I remember, who the head nurse on the unit called in to talk with me while I was lying in bed. And I mean, this man had an eye that was deformed. His ear was half off. He was visibly very, very burned. But nonetheless, he came and he came to let me know there was life after burns. And I think that's so important to let people know who are going through something similar to what you've gone through that there is a life thereafter and that you need to ask not what, why me, but what next.
And I think that in that context, one of the things about finding somebody as an example of what is coming is that there's several mentors in that spot. There can be people who are at a similar point in the journey, who are sharing the actual hardship. But when he came, he was showing you that there would be a change and an end. There would be a transition, that you would not always be in the burn unit, so to speak.
Exactly. And there was a federal judge who, as I mentioned, I was a federal prosecutor and I had the utmost respect. He was the head of the federal bench. And he would stop by at 6 o'clock in the morning. Now, there were no visitors, non-family allowed, but he looked like central casting for a judge. He had white hair, just the kindest face. He'd put on the garments to come into the burn unit, put on the hat that looked like a shower cap, the gown, the shoe covers. And he shared with me that during the war, he had been burned badly by swimming through a sea of oil that was on fire.
Oh my goodness.
I know. And that was so important to me. And he would constantly send me notes. His name was Judge Edward Devitt. And he'd send me notes, "Sincerely, Ed, your clipping agent." And he'd send me pictures of things that I'd been in magazines for, law related things. And so the first place that I wanted to go when I got out of the burn unit after 2.5 months there, my parents took me to the federal courthouse to walk into his chambers. And that was important to me because that had been an incentive. And then my first appearance, it took me a while to get back into the courtroom. I could start 1 hour a day and then 1 hour a week and then gradually build up. My first case was in front of him when I was in the courtroom, and he called up all these lawyers from New York that it were we were trying a very large tax case, and he said, "I just want to welcome Ms. Ramstead back into the courtroom. This is her first time since she was in this crash, and we're so glad to have you back here." Meant the world. So yeah, I totally give Pete credit to those people who walked me through it, who walked the journey with me, who helped me along the way.
Yeah, I mean, you a big chunk of it you had to do by yourself because it happened to your body, but there it's clear that you had a very, very enormous amount of support. This was a very public event in the town that you were in. You put pictures that were in the newspaper of the crash. It's clear that there was definitely an element of you being in the spotlight because it happened, so to speak. Not probably what you were hoping to be in the spotlight for before this happened. You would have been looking for more professional highlights to be the reason you would have been in the newspaper.
The reason I think I chose some of these activities that I chose, some of these challenges, I needed to prove to people, because I'd been a fiercely independent person, and I needed to prove to other people that I was okay, that they could talk to me. I mean, I had ace bandages up and down my arms and legs. It was obvious I'd been burned, but I had to prove to people that I was still capable of doing things that I would have done before. And so that's why I did some of the activities that I did. I wanted to show people the marathon training. My best friend was a television anchor who had read the story of my crash on the air, and my name hadn't even been released. She was one of the people who came over to the hospital, brought me pizzas, and she did a three-part series that was shown throughout the state on our marathon training over months that we got ready for our first marathon. And those were ways in which I could show others that I was still the same person inside. And even though my body outside looked different and was aged and I'd gone through this, and it made me more sensitive to others who have changes to their lives, and to realizing that, that loss of identity for me was my independence. You mentioned being totally dependent on the burn crew and the nurses and others that were taking care of me. That's a pretty helpless feeling. And so I was ready to get back on my feet. It took me a while. It took me 2 years of daily physical therapy to get the use of my hand back. And my arms, I couldn't stand up straight. And so it was a day by day thing. And yet I realized that I needed to do it. Nobody could do it for me. It was mine to do.
And to choose the physical challenges, because one of the things that happens when we replace the skin, and when you went into the burn unit, your training for the marathon, did you have mobility and sweating challenges, like pressure? Like it's like it was one of I do have a very close friend who was as a runner, and he does extreme endurance events, but he doesn't sweat as much because he had his skin, a bunch of his skin was burned, and that's how I am aware of that. But so you're fiercely independent, you're training for extreme endurance events, and part of this is that your actual challenge is slightly different from somebody who has not gone through what you have gone through. You might at some point have to say, hey, my body doesn't work the same way yours does.
Exactly. Like, as you mentioned, perspiring, you perspire through your head, but none of your skin that's been grafted. My arms are grafted, my hands, my legs, have been burned. And none of that skin allows perspiration to go through it. So the only cooling mechanism is the top of my head. And then to compound that, I had to wear a full bodysuit for 2 years every day, zipped up the front, long sleeved, of course, in the summer, gloves, tights. And so that added, an additional problem to overcome, the heat, because that was,
It sounds like it was very hot.
yeah.
Sounds like, and also an outward sign that something was different.
Exactly.
So it was not something you could hide from people. There was an outward indication that something was different, which is puts you in the spot living through it to continually be facing the fact that people are mirroring back to you that they're aware that something is different.
That's very true. In fact, I remember going into the burn clinic one day, and people, I remember standing in the cafeteria line, and somebody turned to me and looked at my body, and they said, "Whatever happened to you?" And I went to the burn clinic, and I said to the doctor, "I didn't know how to answer it. How do I answer that?" And he said, "Just look at him and say, 'Do I know you?' And put question right back at them. And
Yes.
that became my answer because, I understood when it was children, they
Right.
are
They get a
innocent.
pass.
Yeah. And you explain, and you try not to frighten them, but you explain. But adults who don't know you, who ask those questions, you just have to deflect it to protect yourself. At least I did.
Yeah, no, it's I teach, I offer that to my friends and my children and everybody in my family. When somebody comes at with you with something that's generally not very kind and a little combative, the tool is to, turn it back to them, and be like, "Hey, excuse me, what? Or can you say it again? Did you mean to call me out in public as a total stranger there, friend?" And I wish I could say that I was surprised that somebody had said that to you as a stranger in public, but I'm not, unfortunately. People say the craziest things to each other, and that's just part of the human experience. All right. So, one of the things that surprised me that came up in this book, and it's just a surprise because I just wasn't expecting it. The title of the book, you wrote a book, it's called Living Life Full Throttle. And the part of it that I knew before I started was the adventures. But one of the things that's definitely a part of this story is the role of your personal faith as it relates to this journey. So you start by talking about how you happened to crash your plane in front of a Catholic church. But I think that if I remember right, your faith, at least then, was not Catholicism.
No, I've never been Catholic. I attended Catholic church when I was in school because my best friend was Catholic, but I was never a Catholic. I was raised Protestant.
Okay, so religion can be a hot button topic. And we live in a time where people are very divided and there's not a lot of conversations about hot button topics. I tend to do things a little bit differently on this platform and bring it out and say, let's go ahead and put it on the table and make it a part of the conversation because it is a big part of your story. And so I just want to do that, and because it's not about questioning what it is. So you even talk about, so you, how important is was your faith before you had this experience, and did it grow as a direct relation to living through this, I think we have to call it a near-death experience?
Yes, it did. And I think adversity does that. I think, last night I didn't know if my husband would survive. And in the elevator on the way down to the hospital today, I was thanking the Lord that he had survived because I knew where to give the credit because the doctors were surprised that he made it through the night. And so I was flying solo, yes, but the Lord was my co-pilot. I firmly believe that. And I think that I got a letter from the then governor of Minnesota when I was lying in a hospital bed, and he said, "The Lord must not be finished with you yet." And I remembered that, and I felt a responsibility, and later worked with that same governor when he was out of office. And I was commissioner of corrections. Another governor had appointed me commissioner of corrections, and we were able to join together and start the first faith-based institution in Minnesota corrections. And to this day, it's still going. 20 years later, it's a national model. And when I was at a prison fellowship luncheon with him, I looked over and I said, "Governor, I know that judges are the legacy most governors like to leave, and I'm sorry that I didn't give you that opportunity, but maybe this is the plan that the Lord had for us." And he said, "Indeed, indeed." And I think that's what comes from following that inner voice. You don't look to outsiders to say, is this okay? Is this right? You just do what you feel called to do. And that's what I've tried to do. I've responded in ways that other people might have thought made no sense. And the thing that writing this book did is, even to me, there were things that, pieces of my life that I knew they all existed, but I didn't have the box cover to put the pieces all in place. And writing this memoir gave me the opportunity to see how my life unfolded as a result of the accident and my response to it. And my life became, I'd have to say, enriched in many ways as a result of that accident. Although, when I did these support groups at the Burn Center, It was interesting, Amy, because people had all sorts of stories about how their lives had changed from burns. And it sounds strange unless you've been there, but to a person, everybody said that they wouldn't have given up the experience for anything because they feel like they've benefited from it. They wouldn't want to go through it again because it was horrific. It was absolutely, horrific, but they felt like they'd learned something and they were better people because of it. Isn't that interesting?
It is. It definitely is. As I was going to ask you, if you thought that some of these changes that you experienced and some of the personal growth that you went through, whether or not you think you could have experienced, this is a terrible question, and I know it because it's a complete hypothetical in like a vacuum of nothingness. But if you thought you could have experienced them without going through the tragedy of living through the plane crash.
I think I could have. The question is, would I have?
Yeah. And that's
Because,
what makes it a terrible question. It's like imagining something that never happened.
well, no, I was trying to prove myself to myself and to other people. And so I looked for opportunities that were, some might call extreme or out of the ordinary. And also, I was on a trajectory 3 years out of law school that I was, destined to go professionally as far as I could, but all these other avenues might not have been as important to me had I not had this experience.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So you do decide to write a book. You don't write a book directly after. You write the book decades later. Let's talk a little bit about making that decision. What made you decide to write the book about your life?
Well, thank you for asking that because, in many instances, people would see my hands or there'd be some casual reference somebody'd make to the crash I was in, or and people would ask more questions, and they'd always say, "You ought to write a book about your life." And I'd say, "I'm too busy living my life to write a book about it." And I was at that time. I didn't have the time, the perspective. I was raising my family. I was engaged in activities. But a few years ago, I got to the point where I was looking at stepping out of the professional workplace. And I thought, if not now, when? And I've always had the belief that I'd want no regrets when I go to the grave. And one regret I would have had is, what if I had tried to write a book, as other people suggested? And I really believe that it's better to try and fail than never to try at all. And so I thought, I'm going to give it my best. And I had that same thought when I went to law school. I thought, I'm going to give it my best. And if it works out, wonderful. But if it doesn't, I have no regrets. And that's why I wrote the book at that point in my life, is because I wanted to see if it was something that I was A, capable of, and B, that would work out so that I could do it and get to this point where it's published.
And let's talk about the publishing. Is this, I was looking at the imprint, which is what we call the publisher information, and I was trying to figure it out. Is this, did you publish this or did you go through a publishing house or how did you, what publishing avenue did you take?
I went through a publisher in Georgia called Muse Literary. And the way I got connected with Muse is a friend of mine had written a book, and I went out for lunch with her, and she said, we talked about writing a book, and she was going to a writer's conference, as fate would have it, the next week. And she said, if you wanted, I told her of my comment and that it was a time when I was considering it. She said, if you want to go to this conference, I can get you comped in. I have a room you can stay in, and all you have to do is get your airline ticket to New Orleans. Well, I thought, again, it would be an interesting way to explore this further and see how realistic it was. So we went to New Orleans, and that's where I met the publisher, who wasn't the person who was giving the workshop, but was there as somebody that had worked with the person giving the workshop. And that also bolstered my confidence when I saw these other people who were writing, that if they can write, I can write about my story. And that publisher really encouraged me. She said, we don't have a memoir. And she said, your story is really worth our publishing. And so she
It
offered
has a lot
me.
of very dramatic dramatic things in it for sure. When you talk about like pitching a book concept to somebody, because they say 8 out of 10 adults have dreams of writing a book, but most people do not have the hook of, let me tell you about surviving a plane crash and going on to do. I mean, you have a resume that is full of accolades. When you were working on, I'm going to go back to the topic of choosing to do something that could be seen as slightly controversial. When you were putting together this memoir, and you are going to publish and you're going to put it out. Religion and faith and the role of religion is can turn people in different ways. Did you think about not putting that in the story or dialing back? Because I did notice that it's a big part of the story. It's not actually featured in the marketing that it's a faith journey.
Yes, I did give it a great deal of thought, and it was not in initially. And as I worked with an editor who I had met in New Orleans and who's worked with me, she was out of Chicago, and we met once a month via Zoom. And I'd
Okay.
send pages, and then she'd give me feedback, and it would come out in our conversations. And she said, "Cheryl, this is such an important and big part of you." And I said, "But I'm not wanting it to be just for people of faith. I want it to be something that will help all people, burn survivors, adventure seekers. You know, I want it to be broader, have broader appeal." And she
Okay.
said, "I think we can do it in a way. I think you can do it in a way that will allow both, be respectful of other people who may not share your beliefs, but also share who you are. Be true to yourself in that book."
That is you just answered the question that was noodling around in my mind, because when you read, like, it was noodling around in my mind because it is very evident that it's a big part of your personal journey. And then I was trying to just sort of feel you out and figure out whether or not it was an underlying purpose of the book. But that answers that question. And I appreciate you having the courtesy to let me push you on that, because it's not a thing that people talk about in forums like this as much as we probably should. And I hope it did not make you uncomfortable.
Not at all.
Okay.
I think it's a very appropriate question, and I'm really glad you asked it, and I'm glad that you gave me an opportunity to address it.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I think I'm very, I just, I, that was something that came up and I thought I would ask because I was really curious. And that's the benefit of me getting to ask the questions. Okay, so in a minute, we're going to do the final questions, but I want to make sure that we take a second and tell everybody that's listening. The title of the book is Living Life Full Throttle by Cheryl Ramstedt, and it's available on Amazon. And is it anywhere else? Is there another place that people should go to look for it and find it and find you?
It's in Barnes and Noble,
Okay.
in all three versions, and it's also on Goodreads.
Oh, very nice. How long did it take, start to finish, between the day you woke up and said, "Fine, I'll write a memoir," and when you held your copy in your hands?
2 years.
2 years. That's pretty fast. That's pretty fast. Not surprising for someone as driven as you, but it's crazy how in this fast-paced world it still takes years to bring a book into existence. All right. Are you ready for the final three questions, Cheryl?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do it. If you had to pick one meal as your very favorite dinner for all time, like if I was inviting you over for your birthday and I said, "I want to make you your favorite meal," what would you ask for?
Salmon.
So, what, how? Roasted, steamed, poached? Which, how do you like it?
Roasted with and well done. I like well done salmon. I love vegetables with it, just very fresh vegetables, not a lot of sauce, not hollandaise or anything like that on it. For dessert, I'd like just something simple, fruit, just a
Fruit. All
dish.
right. Roasted salmon. I think that cooked, so I mean, obviously sushi, salmon comes with sushi, so that's raw. But I had somebody in a restaurant ask me when I ordered salmon, they're like, "How do you want it cooked?" And I was like, no, cooked. I want my salmon cooked all the way through, please."
Exactly.
So I don't know if that's my own ignorance with salmon, but other things I will order medium rare. But salmon, I'm like, no, I think we cook the salmon all the way through. That's how I like it. All right, so
Yeah, it's
share with
otherwise
us.
it's kind of slimy, isn't it?
That is my take on that. That's just an opinion. I'm not the salmon preparing efficient, but that's how I go through life. So, all right, you are an author and we're talking about a book, but do you read or listen to audiobooks these days? And if so, do you want to share with us a recent book that you have enjoyed?
Yes, in fact, I'm going to be recording my audiobook
Oh,
and
fun.
I just retained somebody to help me with that, so it'll be out in a few months. I love Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about her last days with her husband and writing about his time with John F. Kennedy as his speechwriter
Okay.
and her time with LBJ as his right arm. And I thought it was really a well done book. And in fact, it was so well done that I'm traveling to see her speak and give it live in just a couple weeks. So I really have a great deal of respect for her. And the book is called The Unfinished Story. And basically, her husband had all these boxes from his years with JFK, and they were trying to go through them, but he had cancer and he died prematurely before they finished it. And so that's the unfinished story. So
Wow.
she went into the box and had to put some of the pieces together that he wasn't there to help her with. But
I hadn't heard of that. That sounds really interesting.
it is. She's an excellent writer and it's a fascinating story. And you learn a lot of history.
And that's a part of history that's sort of shrouded forever in uncertainty, and everybody's curious. Everybody's curious. So I think that's a wonderful recommendation. Thank you. All right. When you take vacations these days, do you prefer to travel far away to exotic locations, or do you like to stay closer to home?
My favorite vacations are with my grandchildren and children. And I've just come back from a trip to Myrtle Beach with my six-year-old granddaughter, my daughter, and my son-in-law. And in the month before, I took my 11-year-old granddaughter, who had just graduated from fifth grade. I told her she could go wherever she wanted, and I'd take her and her mother. And we had a wonderful trip. And I love to do that for my family. When I go for myself, I love to go where there's other people that I know. And I love the Chautauqua Institute. Are you familiar with the Chautauqua Institution?
I don't think so.
If not, it's a fascinating place. It's been in existence 151 years. And I, in fact, did a book signing there just about a month ago. It's well known in New York. You fly into Buffalo and then it's about 2 hour drive from there. And that's where Doris Kearns Goodwin is coming to speak, along with Morgan Freeman's going to be there.
Wow.
And next year, Ken Burns is,
Oh my goodness.
they have nine sessions, 9 weeks during the summer. Each week has a different topic, and they bring together the most fascinating, knowledgeable people. And the people who attend are also interesting. And then they have entertainment. They
That's
had
a
the
very varied, like one is Myrtle Beach, land of lazy rivers in the hotel, and the other is the Chautauqua Institute with Morgan Freeman, who I would like to narrate my life.
Yeah, he's going to do a narration there, but they had Diana Krall. They have somebody every night in the amphitheater. They had four symphony concerts the week we were there, one with a world famous violinist. It's just a very exciting, exhilarating, stimulating place. And so I'm going back for my third week this summer shortly. And it's just my happy place.
That's amazing. I'm so glad I asked. That's a delightful answer. That's it. Cheryl Ramstad, thank you so much for being an amazing guest today on the show.
It was my pleasure and such a pleasure to meet you, Amy.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.